This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The wealth gap has been growing for decades, and the difference is particularly stark along racial lines. In the last 50 years, the wealth gap between white families and their black and Latino counterparts has more than tripled. Today, the median net worth of white families is nearly 10 times that of black families. That's according to recent data from the Federal Reserve. So what is causing this huge gap? A new book argues that economic inequality in America is deeply tied to racial discrimination and that rules have been in place for more than a century that prevent access to wealth for African Americans. The book is called The Hidden Rules of Race, Barriers to an Inclusive Economy. And joining me now is Felicia Wong. She's co-author of the book and also president and CEO of the nonprofit Roosevelt Institute. Felicia, welcome to the State of Things.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's talk a little bit about this now. What do we mean when we talk about a wealth gap? And I think we should distinguish wealth from income, right?
Right. It's really important to do that. You know, we've had a conversation about economic inequality in this country for more than 5 years now. But a lot of times people think about income. What's my job? What's my wage? And that's really important. But wealth is even more important because wealth really is about your ability to make decisions long term. Wealth is about how much cushion you have so that you can invest in yourself, you can invest in your kids, you can make a school decision. And wealth also protects you. It's an insurance policy if something goes wrong in your life. So wealth is a hedge against risk. But the other really important thing for African American and Latino families in particular is that wealth and the kind of wealth gap you're talking about, Frank, wealth represents a kind of crystallized history. And if the history of racial rules, particularly with respect to African Americans, has been exclusionary, then the wealth disparities really reflect those generations of inequality.
Well, is it a hangover from a time when these barriers were enshrined in law?
Yes.
Or are these rules? So there's a yes. Because then the second part of the question is, are there rules still in place that reinforce this?
Well, there are many kinds of rules. Let me talk just about two. The kinds of rules that Americans understand and are comfortable talking about with respect to race are very explicit. The slave codes, the skin color-based slave codes, were racialized. Jim Crow was explicit racial discrimination about voting, about where you could live, where you could go to school, who you could marry. So those are explicit rules. But we also have a number of implicit rules. So those rules are now off the books, thank goodness. A lot of hard work, a lot of hard political work took those rules off the book, particularly in the 60s and the 50s, 60s and 70s. But now what we have is a lot of hangover. The racialized nature of our economy is now being driven by a tax code that privileges the wealthy, privileges people who hold capital. It's being driven by rules that privilege large corporations and not smaller businesses. So these rules, which don't on their face look like they're racialized, actually have deep racial outcomes.
But how so? Why are they racial? Because they apply to everybody in the country all at once. And even though they favor the wealthy, tax cuts in this state, tax cuts at the national level have favored the wealthy, particularly in the past decade, without any doubt. And the statistics will show that. But still, it's the rest of the country, the less wealthy, black and white, should be affected equally.
Right. And that would make sense if we all sort of started from the same place. But if you get back to the wealth gap that you opened this conversation with, if black families have three times less, actually much more than three times less wealth, if black families on average have $5,000 to $10,000 in wealth and white families have on average $150,000 in wealth, then we are starting from very different places. So if you then have a tax code that privileges people who are homeowners, people who have enough money to save for their kids to go to college in 529 plans, or owners of corporations or hedge fund managers who are taxed, much of their income is taxed at a much lower level than a secretary, as Warren Buffett famously said, or, you know, somebody who's working a job in labor, then that tax code actually expands the racialized inequality.
Because you started out at because of the slavery, Jim Crow, all of the, and we haven't even got into redlining yet, but all of these things that were legalized racial segregation in the wealth arena. Now, if I get a tax cut and I'm already wealthy, the myth is that I'm going to create jobs with that. But, of course, I invested my 401k. I invested in my portfolio. Most of that money goes abroad.
Of course.
So it doesn't stay locally, and it gets passed on. So here's wealth that if I didn't have it to begin with, I can't pass on to my children. The tax cut didn't help me pass on wealth. It certainly did the wealthy guy who is now investing in foreign investments.
Right. And what you're seeing on the corporate level is very large companies. Are extremely profitable, but they have over $2 trillion in assets that they are hoarding and not investing, in part because the tax code encourages them to do so. Now, what that means when large corporations do not invest, that means they're not investing in jobs for workers, and in particular, they're not investing in good jobs that could go to African American and Latinos. So this becomes a vicious cycle.
Yeah, well, talk about cycles, because in your book, you and your co-authors say that part of the answer to why the wealth gap is a story that involves an ongoing cycle of progress and retrenchment. Tell us more about that.
Right. Well, you know, I think even stepping back from that a little bit, the story of America, the 350-year story of America, is really a story about who belongs and who doesn't belong, both in our democracy and in our economy. Of course, that's become heightened since the election. It seems like we're fighting every single day about who belongs, who's an American. But if you take a step back, the decision to make African Americans, people, immigrants from Africa, slaves, that was an economic decision as well as a moral decision, as well as an ethical decision. So really the kinds of rules that we have crafted for ourselves, the Jim Crow laws that we crafted, and our inability to fully make real the promise of civil rights, all of these are both rights decisions, which progressives and the left are really comfortable talking about, but they're also economic decisions. And that's where I think both the race versus class conversation that at least progressives have been having since the election, what really has caused the Trump phenomena that we've seen, I think that is very much a false construct. It's a false either or. You must be able to look at both.
We are talking about the nature of the wealth gap, particularly along racial lines, and we're talking about that today on The State of Things. The new book, The Hidden Rules of Race, Barriers to an Inclusive Economy, just out. We're now talking with Felicia Wong, who is one of the co-authors and also the CEO of the Roosevelt Institute, a nonprofit. But again, let's talk about some of these rules. They have been moved away. A lot of them have been eliminated, and there have been progress, at least in political rights. Why didn't progress in gaining political rights, the right to vote, and the right not to, the right to equal access, not result in a shrinking of the wealth gap?
Well, when you get to questions about voting rights, and I think we're going to talk about that a little bit later with mm-hmm. my co-author, Dorian Warren. You've seen plain old retrenchment in things like voting rights. But I also want to talk about the ways in which segregation went from enshrined in the law de jure to something that was de facto. So you need to go look at the history of, again, the mid-20th century. And let's look at two things that are really close to everyone's heart, right? Housing and schooling. It became illegal thanks to the 1964 Civil Rights Act. It became illegal to discriminate along housing lines, and it became illegal to discriminate by race actually as early as 1954, of course, with the famous Brown v. Board Act. But what you then saw was a tremendous amount of white flight, white people moving out of neighborhoods that were becoming desegregated. And you also saw a tremendous amount of you saw redlining, the refusal to give African American families good, plain old 30-year mortgages. And so what that really meant was that even though you didn't have laws on the books that explicitly called out people of color, you had a whole bunch of discrimination that was essentially baked into our legal system. Now, a lot of people know that, but at the same time, they also sort of, they look at the racial inequalities that we see today, because those inequalities are very clear to all of us, but they think, oh, maybe the reason that we see African Americans or Latinos or new immigrants in lower wage jobs or not working, maybe it's because they're not working hard enough. Maybe it's because they didn't work hard enough in school. Maybe they're actually lazy. That is the thought bubble that's going on in people's heads. And what they don't see is the cumulative effect of both those laws on the books and then the effect of things like white flight and redlining that really have kept opportunity away from people of color.
And redlining, just to remind everybody, was the federal rules that allowed, that would not allow loans to be made, housing loans to be secured or insured by the federal government if they were in black neighborhoods. It was in the rule that the federal government wrote when it decided to build a middle class, to build wealth among the middle class in the aftermath of the Depression, and systematically ruled out African-American neighborhoods from being able to participate in the loan program.
Right.
And that means there's wealth that you don't pass on because you can't pass on the house to your kids.
And I'd actually like to add something else that is very clear from the Roosevelt history, which is that Franklin Roosevelt, when he made the decision to start the National Labor Relations Board, National Labor Relations Act, did not include domestic workers and agricultural workers in that deal. So you have workers that were primarily black women, black men and women, but domestic workers, women, excluded from the protections of the law.
We'll talk more about that and the wealth gap in general. Felicia Wong, co-author of the new book, The Hidden Rules of Race, Barriers to an Inclusive Economy. Our conversation continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, talking today about the connection between racial discrimination and economic prosperity in America. My guest is Felicia Wong. She's co-author of the new book, The Hidden Rules of Race, Barriers to an Inclusive Economy. She's also the president and CEO of the nonprofit, the Roosevelt Institute. And joining me now are two more co-authors of the book. Andrea Flynn and Dorian Warren are both fellows with the Roosevelt Institute and co-authors of this book. Andrea, Dorian, welcome. Good to have you both here.
Thank you.
Great to be with you, Frank.
Felicia, I want to come back to you because just before the break, you were talking about the National Labor Relations Act, which was protection for offered protection for workers in this country. And I think we're going to talk more about not only the hidden rules that reinforce disparity, but also the absence of rule and regulation that helps people, individuals, work toward their own wealth. NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, and the act that created it was one of those things that helped workers get a foothold, right? But you talked about the fact that the deal Roosevelt had to make to get it built in racial discrimination. Tell us more about that.
Right. Well, let's go back to think about why it's important to unionize to start with. And yes, it's true that the National Labor Relations Act helped individual workers get a foothold, but even more importantly, it helped workers speak with one voice and build power, because Roosevelt well understood that if you were going to have corporate power in a rising industrial America, you also needed to balance that out with worker power so everybody could come to the table to cut a deal that was going to be good for all and not just good for some. However, this was also a time when Congress was controlled by Southern Democrats, and those Southerners could not abide, for a whole host of cultural reasons, actually, even having to do with, you know, white women who employed black domestic help. But there are a whole lot of reasons, emotional, cultural, historical, that made it hard for Southern Democrats to actually have those workers included in worker protections. My colleague Dorian Warren knows a whole lot about it. He's a labor historian, and I'm sure he'll say more.
Well, let's talk more about that, but also this right to aggregate or to collect in general. I mean, I think people don't quite understand, but a corporation there's an aggregation of capital that goes on in Wall Street. A lot of things, it's assembled in a very large amount. And so when individuals want to come together as a union, that would be the counter to that. And it's always been interesting to me how much antagonism there is about individual human beings organizing, but when money organizes in capital and Wall Street, we don't seem to see it the same way. Tell me more about the history, though, and maybe you can springboard off of what Felicia was talking about. In terms of labor relations, what's that got to do with it, and unions? What does that have anything to do with wealth disparity in America?
Well, Frank, there is an important rule to bridge the topics here that helped to create the conditions for that Southern Democratic Compromise that FDR had in terms of New Deal legislation, which excluded certain occupations, which also happened to be black. That major rule was something called the white primary, and it excluded blacks from participation in the Jim Crow South. And so when you have a white primary, meaning blacks couldn't participate, and so Southern Democrats were essentially a one party, a dominant party in the South. There was no two-party competition. And so that rule was in place until 1944 when the Supreme Court overturned it. But if you think about all the major New Deal legislation from National Labor Relations Act in 1935, the Fair Labor Standards Act in 1938, which gave us the minimum wage, all of those have occupational exclusions because of the deal with Southern Democrats. So this is a rule-based story in terms of how we even got there in the first place.
And the reason, pardon me for interrupting, but the reason the Southern Democrats had so much control is because their monopoly gave them pretty much, they had seniority. These guys were being reelected over and over and over again. It was not a competitive system. Seniority in Congress, they controlled the game.
That's exactly right. So it's important to look at the rules of the game as well as the rules embedded in policy decisions that affect not just black Americans, but people of color. And in fact, white Americans, too, because racism not only directly hurts and harms people of color, it also harms poor whites. Along with the voting restrictions in the Jim Crow South, there were poor whites caught up in grandfather clauses and literacy tests. So it's not just that it's specifically focused on black Americans and trying to suppress, say, the black vote. It also harms, in the case especially of the South, poor whites.
But disproportionately ends up affecting
Indeed.
Blacks. And then it gets carried out through in generations, carried over generation to generation. Andrea, you study health outcomes, particularly for women of color. Let's talk about what we see there and what the disparities look like.
Sure. So it's important to note that, you know, we've talked a lot about economic outcomes, but that the rules of our economy and our society not only affect sort of the way we are able to move about the world, but actually how our bodies exist and how we're able to take care of our bodies. And so we look at, in this book, the vast racial disparities in health that still exist, from higher rates of breast cancer among black women to high rates of heart disease, obesity, and an issue that I think is particularly important and that lives at the intersection of all these issues is much higher rates of maternal mortality among black women, and that those higher rates of maternal mortality exist among all education and income levels, which I think points to the fact that there's really something much deeper and problematic going on in our society.
Well, what might that be? What would it be? We've been talking about the rules, embedded rules that can help to sustain this kind of disparity. What are they?
Sure. So there are a number of factors that are driving the high rates of maternal mortality, and some of them are what you would think of: health coverage, poverty levels, economic inequality. But there's actually a lot of research that shows that racism itself, the toxic stress of experiencing racism, actually impacts how our bodies work on a cellular level, and that not only impacts women but also impacts impacts the babies that they bring into this world, and that that impacts an individual's ability to respond to stress, to handle stress, and really sets off a very vicious cycle.
Actually, epigenetic changes that take place under stress that can then get passed on.
Exactly.
And also troubling research that shows even second-generation middle-class African-Americans suffer worse health outcomes than the population in general,
yes,
suggesting that it's not a matter of being born into a good family, a wealthy family, I should say, not a good family, but again, carrying these stressors with you. Well, so then the question again becomes, and health insurance, of course, is an important part of this, whether or not you have it, and obviously it's,
yes,
much more difficult for people. Give us a sense of what kind of impact that might have.
Sure. So health coverage is incredibly important. You know, if you don't have the ability to pay for care, even if there's a doctor down the street, it doesn't mean you have access to that physician. And, you know, as we've seen, a number of states in this country refuse to expand Medicaid. That has had a disproportionate impact on people of color, and particularly women of color. Although, as Dorian said, has also had a negative impact on low-income and working class white communities. But we know that when women have access to coverage, that their health outcomes improve. And that's particularly true for pregnancy outcomes. And in fact, in North Carolina alone, the Black women are almost twice as likely to delay pregnancy care or have prenatal coverage. And that has an incredible has an incredible impact on health outcomes.
Well, Dorian, again, some of this gets back to labor practices and the downward trend in unionization, the ability to fight for these kinds of medical coverage, right?
And yes, Frank, and you mentioned in talking about unions and the rights of corporations, this is a free speech, freedom of association issue. And in fact, in the preamble to the National Labor Relations Act, it talks about the need for countervailing power. It says essentially an individual worker doesn't have the same level of power as a corporation. But to balance that, as Felicia mentioned, if workers combine together their voices, that would create an equal or balanced playing field. So that was the idea in 1935. And then, of course, by the mid-1950s, when one in three workers in the private sector were members of a labor union, we saw that balance in our economy. We saw greater prosperity. We were growing at pretty significant rates overall in terms of the economy. And then we saw something happen in the 60s, 70s, and especially in the 80s, and that is deindustrialization and, frankly, an all-out assault on unions and the right to join a union, so that now there really isn't a private sector labor movement anymore. It's in very few places. We do still have lots of workers in the public sector who are members of unions, but even they are under distress in this moment in terms of their ability to come together collectively and bargain and join a union. So, you know, I think there is a strong correlation. We often say correlation isn't causation, but there is a strong correlation between growing inequality and the decline of the American labor movement and the numbers of American workers who are members of unions.
And not just the labor movement. This brings us to sort of the other side of the equation that you've been examining, not just the rules built into this system, but the rules that aren't there, the protections. And it goes beyond unions. Felicia, give us a kind of a broad view of the sort of protections that aren't there that could help address the disparity.
Right. Well, sometimes we like to say that deregulation, which we've seen run rampant since at least the 1980s. But deregulation is really just re-regulation on behalf of the people who already have power. So that's one way we think about it, whether that's in the banking system, whether that's in sort of the implicit protections that capital has for these very, very large monopolistic companies now. If there are no rules, then those folks are going to make the rules.
Well, the Senate just voted to eliminate, voted down or killed a rule that would have allowed individual Americans the freedom to launch a class action suit against a bank. And the Senate said, no, the banks need to be protected from individuals like us from assembling and creating a class action suit. And the House did something similar, although on a different rule, in March, again, making it harder for consumers to launch class action suits. And so I guess that's one of the things you're talking about.
Absolutely.
It's kind of some some way in which individuals can use their leverage against corporations to build wealth.
Absolutely, because I can guarantee you that corporations and banks and large actors in the financial system can absolutely figure out how to hire the best lawyers to make any kind of defense that they need to. And we've obviously seen this since the financial crisis. But we know who is able to hire lawyers to get themselves essentially off the hook. But can I actually step back to talk about the range of topics that we've been covering here? Because if I'm listening to this show, I'm thinking, wow, these folks started talking about, you know, the hidden rules of race and bringing together the economic conversation and the race conversation, but it sounds so wide ranging. And what I want to acknowledges that, yes, in fact, it is. We started writing this book in 2015 because we were listening to the political conversation around essentially economic populism, the arguments for making a more inclusive economy. And we realized that, wait a minute, we need to also bring race very directly into this conversation. But then we structured our analysis and we structured the book by starting with income, which is where the conversation was then. We then added wealth because, as I said before, wealth is such an important long-term indicator of economic well-being. But then we said we have to add voting rights and access to our democracy, as Dorian said, and we have to add health and health disparities, because even people who are middle class or upper middle class African Americans have far worse health outcomes, as Andrea said. And then, of course, we have to add education, and we have to add criminal justice, which we haven't even started to talk about. But our point, and we tried to do this all in a 200-page book, but we wanted to lay it all out to show that there actually is a web of intersecting rules and non-rules that contribute to these outcomes. And it's important for us to look at them and understand them if we're going to make change.
Dorian, I want to ask you something about that, though, because along those lines, it's important to see, and I think it's been hidden for far too long, this racial correlation and how it fits neatly into the wealth gap. And you pointed out the fact that poor whites and middle-class whites are deeply affected by this as well. But politically, they've been divided quite successfully for perhaps our entire history. How do you make the case, and this is a political question, that what is essentially a problem that disproportionately affects African-Americans and other minorities is also, you know, sort of everybody's problem, and not make it a racial problem anymore, but say, no, it's really only a very few people who are benefiting by this thing?
Well, that is the age-old question of American democracy, and especially the state of North Carolina. There was a moment post-Reconstruction when, in some ways, there was a multiracial populist movement right here of poor whites and poor blacks who came together in the voting booth, who organized together and elected governments that actually represented them, vis-a-vis the elite, who were mostly the white planter class. And so then there was a counter strategy to divide. And this is one of my favorite books that we cite in our book is The Strange Career of Jim Crow by C. Van Woodward. And it documents how Jim Crow didn't come immediately after Reconstruction. It actually didn't start until about 1899, 1900, which I think 1899 is the year North Carolina changed its constitution to start to exclude blacks. As I mentioned earlier, as blacks were excluded through restrictive voting laws, as is the case today, apparently in North Carolina, it also captured poor whites. So if you were illiterate or you didn't have money for the poll tax, you couldn't vote whether you were black or white. So in that sense, it affected poor whites, and who should have seen their fates linked to poor black people. And in some cases they did, and lots of other cases, and you're right that this is a political question, we still struggle with linking the fates of blacks and whites in this country. And as Andrea could tell you, now we have all this health data on working class and downwardly mobile whites and how their life expectancies are actually going down, in some ways becoming more equal with blacks, but that's not the kind of equality I think any of us aspire to. And it's because some of the policies that white voters have supported because of their racial self-interest have undercut their economic self-interest and explicitly their life expectancy. So we have to have a different kind of conversation.
We are talking about the hidden rules of race today on The State of Things. the title of a new book, and I have three of the co-authors with me, Andrea Flynn, Dorian Warren, and Felicia Wong. Let me ask you more about those health disparities, because in fact, the health outcomes for poor whites are declining faster now, according to some of the latest data. But there are other issues here that I think we haven't talked about, Andrea. Infant mortality rates as well in the U.S. that are often overlooked. Tell us
more. Yes, that's true. I mean, the infant mortality rates often mirror what we see with maternal mortality rates. So we know that the infant mortality rates for the children born to black women are anywhere between 2 and 4 times as high. And that, again, exists across income and education lines. So, you know, what Felicia was talking about earlier, we often tell people, you know, you just need more education, you just need to work harder. But that idea of pulling yourself up by the bootstraps really doesn't apply for black women, and that actually there is some sort of risk involved with moving up the income and education
what
ladder.
Kind of, tell me more about that. Risks?
And by that I mean facing higher levels, higher rates of maternal mortality and infant mortality.
So, Felicia Wong, tell me where you see things headed, because I think you've pointed in a number of cases to indicators that suggest we're not going to get better anytime. Do you see any ways that this can turn around?
Well, a number of very important and prominent political figures have pointed out that you should never let a good crisis go to waste. And I think it is very clear that American society, American politics, and the American economy and American democracy is in a state of crisis. I'll tell you what I'm encouraged by right now, though. Assuming we can get through the very, very difficult fighting that we seem to be doing on a sort of on a civic basis, the number of big ideas that are now being floated and experimented with and talked about are like nothing I've ever seen in my career. So we are talking about very big ideas now to expand the social safety net. We're talking about job guarantees, which would have the government actually ensure that people could work. We're talking about expanding things like basic income. We're talking about single-payer health care. These are very big ideas that could bring us to a pro-growth economy that would benefit all.
Felicia Wong, Andrea Flynn, and Dorian Warren, co-authors of the new book, The Hidden Rules of Race, Barriers to an Inclusive Economy, part of a conference taking place today at Duke University. Thank you all for being on the program.
Thank you.
You can find out more about their work at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, a talk with comedian Jen Kirkman about her upcoming stand-up in North Carolina. Please stay with us.